how to start?
Well, you know, it's just writing. I mean,
here's something important to remember about dialogue.
Every word matters.
No, it doesn't.
They're vital.
I want to go to this place that I think it needs to go to.
The only thing that counts is what you see on the screen.
I will write like 4, 5, 6 hours a day.
And it will be a voice made of ink and rage.
Okay, I'm really glad you asked me that question.
Welcome back to the show. In this episode, I sat down with Dave Boll, the screenwriter and creator for Netflix's House of Ninjas. He's also got credits for films like Big Dreams, Little Tokyo, White on Rice, Surrogate Valentine, Daylight Savings, and Man from Reno. In this interview, we talk about writing for genre, what it means to write, quote, sinister whimsy, how he moved from movies to television, and the complications of never writing a series before, being more familiar with films than TV, never running a writer's room before, and also doing all this in his second language, Japanese. Here is my conversation with Dave Boll. You can also find this on Creative Screenwriting's website.
I wanted to be a filmmaker for as long as I could remember. At first I wanted to be an animator. And then I got more into live action as I went along. And then I think that screenwriting was always sort of, I always wanted to be a writer director. And then I think when I made my first couple of independent films, I was making more of my living as an editor. That was sort of the thing that allowed me to kind of make a living while in between projects that I was making and that kind of thing. And then I didn't really start pursuing, screenwriting as a profession until after I had kind of done a couple of these like micro budget films and stuff. And I started writing spec scripts. And that was when I sort of became really, really passionate about just the writing itself as the end result. So I think it was always sort of, you know, it was always a passion of mine, but I think that from the beginning, I sort of had this kind of omnivorous, I'm going to be a jack of all trades, I'm going to do it all kind of thing. And some of those other things that I was focusing on slowly melted away as I didn't need to do them for a living anymore. And also things that I was doing that I wasn't necessarily that great at. And then as I started just focusing more on writing, then I wrote my first couple of spec scripts. And then, after the last feature film I made, especially called Man from Reno, that was when I started to just get more jobs as a screenwriter. And that was, so the passion was always there, and then it didn't become sort of the main focus of my career for a long time.
How did directing and editing change your writing? Did they make you think about it differently or more visually or anything like that?
They definitely did, because I found, especially in my, early on, that I was sort of, you end up in trouble in editing, and then you realize that, if I had done this and this, and when I was writing, then I wouldn't be in this, pickle right now. So it became, I think it definitely taught me a lot about structure. And I think that, I was making a lot of arrogant mistakes in terms of, in terms of my writing that I thought that I could sort of get through with directing and editing. And it definitely changed my perspective on, the kinds of things that I like to write as well, because I was experimenting a lot, and eventually I just kind of realized that, the stuff that I was sort of addicted to reading, like, this is probably the stuff that I should be writing, I think initially I sort of saw myself as being like a very slice of life, somebody who was more suited to like human dramas, that kind of thing. But in everyday life, it's like I'm looking at a bookshelf that's full of like, Dashiell Hammett novels, detective stories and thrillers and things like that. And then I realized that, that's sort of my true passion is for genre. And you know, I should be really writing the kinds of things that I'm reading and watching all the time, instead of kind of trying to fit myself into a, you know, the whole square peg into a round hole kind of thing.
Is there anything more specific you can say about what makes your work, like anything like the niche within the niche of genre? Like, what do you kind of see all your work as?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think what I bring specifically to, you know, whatever I write is a sense of suspense that's with a light touch, you know. I think that I heard somebody describe something else as like sinister whimsy. And I always liked that expression and sort of felt like, oh, that's sort of what I like, you know, because I always really like suspenseful stories that sort of wrap you up in it, but also have characters that are very human and frail and, you know, and humorous in a way. And so, you know, I can't point to like a single movie or anything that has exactly what I've always been. I feel like I'm always aiming for something that I don't quite see anywhere else, you know? But maybe sinister whimsy is I'm trying to remember who that was. That quote was described. It was probably like Edward Gorey or something like that. But I don't know. I have a really hard time self-evaluating. I'll put it that way.
Is it hard to pitch when you're trying to pitch something that kind of combines a series of things? Like, how did you go? What was the original idea for House of Ninjas? How did you go about talking about the project?
Well, House of Ninjas started as an assignment. It was, you know, Kento Kaku, the star, had this idea, this concept, ninja family in modern Japan, and he took it to Netflix and they wanted to make it. And then they asked, you know, what would your take be on it? And, you know, and my take was basically that, you know, instead of focusing on ninjas as basically just stealth killers as their job, to focus on, you know, being a ninja as an identity, that they have these traditions that are passed down, that they're living by a set of very, very out of date rules. They still only do arranged marriage. You know, they have a lot of dietary restrictions. They don't drink or anything like that. So that they feel very displaced and out of time. And also, you know, historically ninjas were always kind of under the thumb of a more powerful clan who used them, and they were expected to kind of follow orders blindly. And I felt that was a really, really interesting, you know, conflict and dilemma to kind of put into modern times, because it's so antithetical to kind of the modern life in every way. So seeing people who by all appearances are ordinary, but they're living by this very, very ancient code, It felt to me like there was something to mine there character-wise. So that was my pitch. And they hired me just to write a Bible first. And the idea was that they were going to take that and, you know, continue developing it into a show. And then eventually, you know, my scope of responsibility kind of expanded more and more to writing. You know, I wrote the pilot episode, and then I became the director, and then I became the showrunner. And then, but it all started as basically just like, you know, a phone call asking, hey, do you like ninjas? And then it kind of went on from there. But I think that, you know, the fun part to me was just kind of imagining if the ninja clans of 500-600 years ago, if they had somehow continued in secret, you know, what might their descendants look like, and what sort of problems would they have? And I sort of felt like once we had that engine, then you know that there was an endless series of stories that you could tell, and, you know, unresolvable conflicts that all of them could be sort of grappling with, and it would be really, really interesting and fun to write.
And you've got a lot of films to your name, spec scripts to your name. Have you written other series before? Was it difficult to kind of shift from writing movies to writing TV?
I don't have any TV credits up till now. I've written, you know, and sold pitches and everything like that, but nothing that ever made it across the finish line. I definitely think it was a learning curve, especially since I was doing it in my second language as well. And so there's not, you know, even though I had done writers' rooms and stuff before, there's not really a writers' room culture in Japan. And so kind of learning a whole kind of new process of collaboration and a new format as well, because scripts are just different there. I think that there were a lot of challenges involved. And so, I didn't feel like we had to follow the rules of necessarily like the structure of a TV show where because it's a short season, it's only 8 episodes. I definitely wanted to make sure that every single one of the characters had like a plenty to do, and they each had their own individual storylines that could run concurrently, and having the balance of, you know, how much each character appears in each episode and how, you know, how much we sort of let them how much progress we let them make on their journey, and, you know, not dragging things out too much, keeping the pace up. All those things were new challenges to me. But I really enjoyed the broader canvas as well, and being able to have a little bit more time to let the characters' individual storylines, you know, let them get lost in the Hall of Mirrors for a little while before all of the pieces of the mystery kind of come together. So it was very challenging, but also a lot of fun. But I will say that the language difference definitely was, that was something that I, you know, that was a big challenge, a fun challenge, but a big challenge.
So we've talked to a lot of people about, you know, the Chinese box office, which often just translate to like bigger monsters, bigger explosions. What was kind of different about this? Were you writing this for an American/Japanese audience? Does that just mean it's more subtle in nature, or what was kind of the tone you were trying to replicate for the audience?
I think we were trying to go for sort of a new and unique tone that hopefully would translate into, or that hopefully people worldwide could appreciate. But the primary focus of, you know, this was a Japanese show that's meant for primarily for Japanese audiences. But since it's Netflix, since it's a worldwide, you know, platform, then it's meant to be seen worldwide. But I think that, you know, once we sort of got going, it just became less about, you know, which, you know, focusing necessarily on you know, which audience we're aiming for, and more like what is the tone that we're trying to get at. And, you know, what we wanted to meld was a family drama that had, you know, really lovable characters, and meld that with a really, really hard hitting ninja show, you know, that has a mystery revolving around a conspiracy that, you know, the central premise being that every unsolved mystery in Japan can be explained by the presence of ninjas. You know, that's sort of the underlying basis of the show. But then the people who are sort of wrapped up with having to resolve that is a family that, you know, that feels very real. That just feels like if you saw them on the street, they just feel like an ordinary Japanese family in 2024. And so the tone became, you know, a balance of the playful and the kind of nostalgic, poignant, and then the suspenseful, mysterious, you know, ominous and that kind of thing. And so it was this kind of combination of tones that to me felt just right, but also was every step along the way, it took a lot of discussion with everybody to kind of make sure that everybody's on the same page of what we were trying to accomplish there.
How detailed are your action scenes? So I've talked to a few martial arts, movie writers, that kind of thing. You know, one rule is that the action needs to move the plot forward, not just be action for action's sake. But how detailed do you go in? Do you describe fighting styles or weapons or some of those things? What does it look like actually on the page for people?
In some places, we first of all, Japanese scripts tend to describe action a lot less, even just staging instructions. I was shocked when, you know, I think that for one of our hour long episodes, the scripts would be about 23 pages or something like that. So, you know, take for example, the Walter Hill style of screenwriting, just very, very sparse. I feel like the typical Japanese script might be even more sparse, you know, and just a lot of blank on the page. But that being said, all of our action sequences, we tended to lay out, you know, maybe not blow by blow, but at least having like the weapons set out, who's against the environment, you know, the environments and kind of the key beats of the scene laid out, and then having enough sort of room in there so that the action choreography can kind of expand on it a little bit, but the key beats are definitely laid out in the script, and then some more than others. You know, I'd say that the action sequences in episodes 1 and 8 are laid out in a lot of detail, whereas in some of the other ones, it's maybe a little bit more of like they fight, you know, and then that one or two line sentence might end up being 2 or 3 minutes of screen time. So
how did you kind of shift to the sparse style? Did you sort of overwrite and then cut back, or how do you think about, you know, making it tighter like that?
I really had to change my mode of thinking in a lot of ways, because you know, and there was also sort of, there are different schools of thought on that too, because there are folks on the team on the production side who sort of wanted to use this as an opportunity to maybe try a different format or change Japanese screenwriting a lot, because there's you know, just like a lot of people, you know how people here, screenwriters on Twitter especially, will argue about screenwriting format all day long, and about what's the best way to do it, what's the right way, what's the way to get people to read your script. If you do this, nobody's going to read your script, blah, 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 all that kind of thing. And what I found on this job is that those kind of arguments are universal. No matter what, you know, language or what country's industry you're in, there's going to be these arguments about what, you know, what's better. And so there were a lot of people who wanted to, they liked the more detailed American scripts that they would get translations of, because because they were like, well, we can look at it and we understand what's happening in the scene just by reading the thing. I think that's a little bit of an exaggeration. You know, it took me a moment to kind of get into the rhythm of, you know, sort of how scripts are formatted and how they're thought of. Like, I'll give you an example. I have my scripts right here. The other thing is, you know how we have like sort of a printed out PDF, and then everybody just jams in kind of colored pages on whenever there's a new revision, pink revision, blue revision. Yeah. There, you know, everything is bound and published as this beautiful book, and you know, you can revise it, but you know, but it's not, you don't have sides every day. It's everybody has their book and everything's in it. I actually started to see some of these formatting changes. Basically, it'll have a line of dialogue that's just dot, 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 you know, and basically just telling you that, you know, the character is going to have a reaction there, that there's probably going to be a close-up of that character. It tells the actor like, okay, I'm on there. What am I going to do? Kind of thing. But you know, it's a sort of a puzzling thing at first, because there's a lot of, you know, and I've actually started to see Like the script for Killers of the Flower Moon was the first time in an American script that I had seen that before, because they started doing that. And I sort of wondered if maybe, you know, because Silence had like a Japanese language script. I sort of wondered if that's just me theorizing. But there are a lot of things like that, you know, characters' actions will be written as lines of dialogue, all parentheticals. You might see a whole scene that's just all parentheticals. And the kind of expressions that were in there are things that just don't translate very well. And so it took me a moment to kind of get into that mode and realize that, you know, at first, my first drafts would be in English, and then I would have them translated. But then I started to try to work more and more in Japanese, just because the, you know, I mean, first of all, there's no direct translation. And also, you know, just the format is so different that it felt like I was kind of going the long way around by starting out in English in a lot of ways.
Well, it's so many things going on. As you shifted from writer to director to showrunner, what were the other unexpected difficulties of being the showrunner, besides the language barrier and everything else you've mentioned?
I mean, I think just the sheer amount of decisions that have to be made in a day, and things that you have to kind of simulate every single sort of possible way that something could go wrong. You know, you got to make a decision now for something that you're shooting in 6 months down the road, you know? I think for me, especially since it was my second language, the biggest challenge was learning how to communicate what I wanted without micromanaging, or without giving the perception of micromanaging, because I had a wonderful, wonderful team, and I wanted to make sure I was getting the best, their best ideas. I didn't want them to feel like I was overriding them in a way. And it's really easy, especially, I did feel like I got lots and lots better as I went along. But at first, I do feel like sometimes when I was trying to start a discussion by thinking out loud, like, you know, in a typical writer's room in America, somebody might raise their hand and say, just first bad idea territory here. And then, you know, you talk about it, and then you develop it, you talk about it together. I try to do that in Japanese, and people would just sort of feel like, oh, he wants to do that, that's the directive, that's what we're doing, kind of thing. And I had to sort of learn new modes of communication that, you know, that are not necessarily like a language barrier so much as just, you know, just the delicacy of human communication is such a, you know, it's challenging even in your native language. So then you just, you know, you put that in a different language and culture, and it's doubly so. But, you know, I would say that was a really positive experience for me. And I loved it once I got into it, just because, you know, it's like the world's, it's just amazing to be able to work with a team like that, and to be able to have these ideas and make them actually happen, and have people who can make those ideas better and everything. So, it was my first time sort of being in the hot seat in that way, but I loved it. It was a great, great experience.
What was maybe your self-talk in the beginning? Because there's so many different types of obstacles, not just shifting from kind of a writer director of films to possibly running a showroom, but like so many things. Did anyone try to talk you out of doing this? Like, how did you have kind of the inner confidence to know that you could maybe just compartmentalize your way to figure out all the small pieces?
I think part of what helped it is that this was just sort of a little by little shift. You know, I was hired on a job to write a show Bible. And so I did it. And then it's like, well, that was pretty good. Can you write a script or something? And I think it was, you know, what's the expression? The boiling frog. You know, you just don't, it's sort of like before you know it, suddenly you're running the whole thing and you're directing, and, you know, you have all these responsibilities and everything. But there was never like that kind of, I mean, people always say there's no, you know, the green light is not an on and off switch. It's always sort of a, it's always on a fader kind of going up, and then it can go down again. And then you sort of realize, oh, we're in trouble. And so I think that, you know, I always felt like I could do it. It was just, you know, I was definitely being thrown into the pool in the deep end without fully realizing it. And I definitely didn't have, you know, the training and preparation that typically comes with that. So I know that was a very, very sort of, turned out to be a very lucky thing. It could have been a very bad experience, and then it would have been a bad thing. But I just had to kind of sink or swim. One thing that really helped me was just that the person who wanted me on the most was Kento Kaku, the star and, you know, the executive producer and original creator of the show. And so his confidence gave me confidence. The first time he ever saw my name was when he read the show Bible based on his idea. And he was just like, who is this guy? And looked me up and watched my movies. And he sort of was sort of the primary mover of like, let's just have him, like, he speaks Japanese, let's have him do it. And you know, I just find that sometimes it just takes a handful of people who are sort of rooting for you and feel like you can bring what they need for their project in order to kind of get that, you know, the confidence and not only the confidence that you need, but also the break that you need, just, you know, from a career's perspective, to get the job in the first place.
Well, I appreciate your time. We'll just do one more, almost out of time. If you could go back to 2005, 2006, early in your career, is there any advice you wish you had, or any advice you'd like to pass on to up and coming writers?
Yeah, I think I would have urged myself to read more this is advice to my specific self. I think I would have advised myself to do a few more drafts on my scripts before I actually went into production, because I do feel like I had this insane confidence that young men often have, that, like, you know, this is great, we're going. And then I feel like it took a few years for me to kind of develop my writing chops to match the confidence that I had as, you know, as an entrepreneurial filmmaker. I also think that the other thing that I learned, you know, in those first years is just that enjoying the writing for writing's sake is very, very important, because it's like I just think of all the many, many scripts that I wrote, you know, for hire or on spec, or all these things that for one reason or another didn't end up happening, you know, not necessarily through any fault of my own, but I definitely got to a place where writing itself was just so enjoyable that you know, all of the rejection and just the crazy ups and downs that the industry have stopped bothering me as much as they did when I was younger, because it's just so arbitrary why one thing is greenlit and another thing isn't. And you know, there are things that you can do to help yourself get that green light, but also, you know, there's a good deal of luck involved, and loving the craft of writing and the act itself, I think has been something that has kind of saved me from, you know, falling into depression when things weren't happening. Cause this is my last film was released or came out 10 years ago. And so I've sort of navigated the development hell landscape for a long, long time before something kind of made it through the noise and got produced. So, you know, there's something to be said for persistence.
Thanks so much for tuning into the show. Before you take off, I want to give you a free gift. I'm giving you my first book, Ink by the Barrel, for free. That's the digital download and audiobook at brockswenson.com. Inside this book, you learn how to annihilate writer's block by embracing Elizabeth Gilbert's playful trickster mentality. You can learn to weaponize your anxiety with Kevin Kelly's different is better approach, and learn how to defend your time with Ryan Holiday's calendar anorexia mindset. There's just a few other ideas in the book, Ink by the Barrel. It's also based on over 400 interviews I've done right here on Creative Principles. So go steal that book right now, Ink by the Barrel, to learn how to be a prolific writer. You can get your copy, that's digital download and audiobook, at brockswinson.com, brockswinson.com. And if it's your first time here, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time. Make sure to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode.